This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashrin Johan, and on the show with me today is Elise Arya Chen, a passionate human rights advocate who works closely with the refugee community. She's also currently a coordinator at the Coalition of Burma Ethnics Malaysia, also known as COBAM, and she's also been with Tenaga Nita and a couple of other NGOs. Welcome to the show, Elise. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good as well. Excited to talk to you about your journey. Maybe you can start with COBAM. Tell me about COBAM, the work you do there, and some of the other ways you've been working with the refugee community as well.
Okay. So COBAM is a coalition group of 8 different community-based organizations, CBOs. And while these different CBOs have their own services for their own ethnic groups here in Malaysia, and its services to support their welfare, they come together in COBAM with the theme of unity in diversity, noting that back in Myanmar, a lot of these ethnic minorities don't engage and work together. But coming here in Malaysia, they've gotten organized and they've seen the sense more is better in supporting. So they come together to do joint programs like mobile clinics, youth camps, outreach trips, and advocacy as well. And my work with them is essentially any technical support that they need. Previously, I worked with them for 3 years under Tenaga Nita, and a lot of that work was reporting to funders, the proposals, the reports. But now that we don't have a funding organization, it's a lot more of whatever else that's required. So sometimes I feel like I'm a consultant of sorts. I'll sit in on meetings and where they need a bit of more insight, especially coming from a local perspective, that's where I can step in. Apart from that, then it's other small work. Like, for example, now we're working on finalizing their website together and streamlining their social media presence a little bit more. So it's things like that. My other work with the refugee community, I think that I would define it as working directly with refugee leaders and their organizations. While I do help in creating the programs that go directly to the refugee community, like trainings and classes, other sort of empowerment efforts, I do it through the community leaders and their organizations. I feel like instead of doing it through our own NGOs or as a local person, I get to not only support them in building the credibility, building the presence of their own leadership within that community, but I also get to tap in onto that insight that I don't have, the lived experience they have as refugees as well. So work like this, I would do with groups such as MIRO, the Myanmar Ethnic Women Refugee Organization, as well as a refugee advocacy group, REACT, which is a Refugee Action for Change. And it's always about putting the refugees at the center of the work instead of as an NGO person coming in and taking over.
And why did you choose migrants or refugees' rights as the area of advocacy that you like to focus on?
So I think in general, for me in my career, I see myself working with any marginalized and underserved community. And that's just the most important part for me. When I started my job here in the nonprofit sector a few years ago, I wanted to work specifically on migrant issues because I recognized their significant presence here in Malaysia. And I'm sure you're familiar with the usual rhetorics, right? A lot of people question why are migrants even important here and you know, all the issues that they tie and scapegoat with the migrant community that made me felt that for all the things that they've gone through, you know, having to sell land and having to take out debts and come here to Malaysia only to be cheated by agents and employers and build our country for us. There's so much more to help this community. So I had wanted to do that. But when I had applied for my job with Tenaga Nita, they didn't have that program, that role rather, available for me. And they placed me under the Refugee Action Program instead. And at that time, I was familiar of, you know, definitions of refugees, what happens, where they go. But I was just like a lot of people where if you say refugees in Malaysia, I go, okay, Rohingya. And I think there's some Syrians here. I didn't know much else at all. So I think it was such a great experience ending up in this particular cause because I've learned so much. I've now come to realize that this issue is so much more complex. The population is so much more bigger and diverse and just a different kinds of origin stories that you hear and the kind of inspiring people that you meet within the refugee community itself is something so interesting.
Let's talk about the refugee community. Can you describe what their reality is in Malaysia? What are the challenges that they go through?
I think the main crux of the issue always goes back to the fact that they're not legally documented or recognized in Malaysia. So they don't have, there's no specific visa or documents that says that they're a refugee that's issued by the Malaysian government. This means that they don't have the right to work, they don't have the right to formal education, and they don't have accessible and affordable healthcare. And you know, when you don't have the right documents, then you can already imagine the security issues, whether it's from immigration, police, but also access to justice. So whenever they get into any form of human rights violation, if a woman has been raped, she might not actually go to the police station to report it because she fears the police more than anything else, right? So the issues are so vast. I think you also have to remember the context that made them refugees in the first place that makes this all so much more alarming, that a lot of them have come from backgrounds where they've experienced firsthand conflict. They've experienced people getting killed. They've probably experienced some form of sexual assault themselves. They've seen families being torn apart. They've probably had to come into Malaysia through very dangerous routes and means. And when they come here, they come with a lot of baggage and a lot of trauma. And being in a host country that doesn't accept them, that alienates them, I think also does something to their mental health and their ability to build a life for themselves that it's better than where they've come from, but also to look forward. And I think that's an interesting thing to be mindful of, is the resilience that they have despite the previous and existing challenges that they're facing as refugees.
How many years has it been since you started your advocacy journey? Have you always been this passionate about advocacy and activism? I mean, did you grow up in a family where your parents talked to you about social politics and social justice?
So I've only actually been doing this for about 3.5 years now, but it feels like at least 6 to 10 years, honestly, the amount of things that I've learned. But I think what has gotten me really interested in this hasn't really been because my family discoursed a lot about social politics, social justice, and all of that. In fact, I don't think much at all that our family ever dabbled into these kind of things. If anything, just things in passing that I picked up, maybe a few things that my mom have said that kind of made me lean towards being more feminist and more left-wing. You know, with my dad, conversations around politics has always been the very Malaysian context, right, of ruling party, opposition party, which is not the kind of political discourse that I enjoy. I like looking at left-right spectrums and whatnot. But I think for me, maybe it was eventual journey into advocacy through some of my own childhood experiences. I grew up in a household that had several elements of abuse. And so from a very young age, I really knew what it was like to be victim to someone regularly, to experience trauma and a sense of hopelessness and helplessness. I also had very extreme social anxiety growing up. So that led me to being more alienated from the people around me. So I think I got a lot of time to be alone and to think and try to make sense of everything. One thing that I think I learned, you know, when you're alienated, to be socially ostracized in a sense, but it gives you a certain feeling and perspective. And so whenever I saw someone out there who I felt might be experiencing something similar, you know, a homeless person who's alienated from the surroundings around him, from someone who's struggling, who feels just hopeless and helpless, I think I felt really strongly for them. And as the years went by, I kept unpacking these issues, like why does struggle have to exist in this world? Why does inequalities happen? Why does poverty still exist in a system like this that's supposed to be efficient? And that kind of just led me a lot more to unpacking the systemic factors of oppression and discrimination and struggle. And while I had initially wanted to do social work just in general to help manage cases, I realized that while that is helpful, the most significant thing we can do is also to try to tackle the systemic issues. And that's where advocacy and activism comes into play. I came from a very privileged background to most extents. I've come from a middle-class family for as long as I can remember. I think the only time that we dipped into poverty was when I was a very young child. So I didn't know struggle. I had books. We didn't have a lot of toys growing up. My mom didn't always thought the books were better than the toys.
as most Asian parents.
Yeah, but I'm very thankful for that. I love reading and I think it's helped me shape this perspective and who I am today as well. But I think when I look at how come I have all these things? And when I go outside and I see people who don't have these, right? I see children who don't have the same access to these things that I know as the most normal thing for a child to have, to be stimulated with books, to have a roof over their head, to feel safe. I just felt that inequality was something that just really unsettled me. I know what it's like to have endured some sort of struggle, to be victim to someone, to feel like this is the environment that I'm trapped in forever. That the moment that I grew up and realized, hey, I'm now an adult and I have power over how I want my life to be, I decided that I wanted to be, I don't want to be cliche, but I want to be the change that I want to see in the world. I don't want to complain about things and expect policymakers and other people to get on with it. I want to be the person that also puts my money where my mouth is and actually stand there and do the work itself. Because I think that collective action from each of us to do something small, whether you want to have a career in this sector or you just do your regular charitable things, right? You be a really kind and altruistic person throughout your life. It really helps. And I guess it was just trying to figure out what is the person that I want to be and what's my purpose in this entire world.
Speaking of purpose, right? In a recent interview with Malaysia Kini, you actually mentioned something that really stood out to me. Something that perhaps I've wrestled with in the past as well. And what you said was, and I quote, "I don't have a want for luxury. I need a purpose in life." Talk to me about this dichotomy, luxury versus purpose. And how did you break away from conventional ideas of success and be comfortable with the idea and perspective that you have right now?
I think for some parts, I remember distinctly growing up and seeing how already so many people put a lot of emphasis on material wealth. But at the same time, they seem really miserable. And a lot of times I also saw money to be the cause of misery. That, you know, that whole saying of money can't buy happiness, I felt that was really true in the environment that I grew up with. On one hand, like the luxuries that we have, the privileges that I had really helped me. But I think excessively, that's just unwarranted, unneeded when there are so many people who are really struggling on a basic scale, right, of putting food on the table. When I think about, you know, I envision myself, you know, in the two different paths, me being really successful, being in a corporate job, you know, getting all the promotions that I think would classify as success, and then versus the life, the path that I'm on right now, to potentially be working in sectors that don't pay me well, that I will not be able to purchase my own house or my own car, and all these things. But I think it's the experiences, right, and the lessons that I'll probably learn on this path that I'm on. Because when I look at my peers who are working corporate jobs and see how they don't find what they're doing in any way purposeful, and when they have to ask themselves that question of, is it really worth it? Like, am I getting paid enough for this, you know, and you still see that doubt that people have versus like on this hand, like I do ask myself that as well, like, is this really worth it? I'm not getting paid a lot at all. And it's such a challenging role having to deal with so many different humans and systems and stakeholders. But I think the motivation for it is it drives me forward a lot more. I don't know. Like, I don't think it's something very technical. I think it's also just something that I felt has been within me since a very young age. I just don't see money as something that can bring true happiness. I think it's purpose. And I like to say that a lot of studies have also shown, has supported this as well. So I like to think that this is the right way to go ahead with.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. But we do need to go for a very quick break right now. I'm speaking with Elise Arya Chen, coordinator of the Coalition of Burma Ethnics Malaysia. We'll be back on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan. And on the show with me today is Elise Arya Chen, coordinator of the Coalition of Burma Ethnics Malaysia. And we're having a chat about her advocacy and activism journey so far and some of the lessons she's picked up along the way. You mentioned that politics in Malaysia is so centered around this party versus that party. Now, whenever I talk to activists who work with refugees, we always end up talking about how Malaysia needs to ratify the UN Refugee Convention, but more importantly, we need policies in place to ensure that refugees have access to healthcare, education, etc. But I have a slightly different question for you. What do you think the problem with our political landscape is right now and over the years that these brilliant ideas don't actually come to fruition?
I think a lot of us know, like, the bigger issues of what's wrong with our political landscape, you know, is the existence of these dinosaurs that are still around, you know, representing views of a very diverse population that is not very well represented at all, right? We've got people from elite social classes trying to dictate the laws or to shape them to represent even the B40 women who are living in plantations, who have completely different realities from them. So I think there's such a huge detach from what the politicians see and then what the policies actually cover and need to address. But I think when I look at in relation to why these things are not happening, the refugee rights that we are fighting for, I see one of the issues is that the policies that we do, I feel, is done because we want the votes, right? Or they want the votes. So it's not necessarily things that they believe in or really want to push, but because they feel like, oh, this is probably a safer thing to work on to get us the next election. And that gets us away from things that are progressive in the sense that upholds human rights, right? Like we look now in during the pandemic and how government, for most part, is trying to crack down on migrants and refugees. A lot of xenophobia happened, especially last year, and it's still continuing on today. And these are things that politicians also champion. And I feel that it's because they know that the scapegoating really helps. It's the us against them tactic that has been used throughout political history that really wins that favor. It leverages on people's strong emotions to garner that support. And I think because they operate by this, when we look at giving refugees rights, you know, the right to work, I think a lot of politicians, a lot of ministers who are currently in power now even see the sense in it. The numbers really add up. It would be really good for our economy. It would be really good for our local community when we learn how to assimilate them better instead of resisting them, because now it's just only creating so much conflict and so much hate, and we really can't afford that kind of energy right now. While they see this sense, they won't sign it on, because the moment you say, oh, refugees get the right to work, when Malaysians already who have a flawed understanding on how the economy works and how, you know, just because refugee takes some job, that doesn't mean that you lose all your job. Because they had that flawed understanding, they're just going to straight away go onto the streets and they're going to say, now you give the foreigners our jobs and now we're going to overthrow you, you know? So I think they're being more careful about these decisions, not based on, will this really help Malaysia, but more so of, will this really help us or not? I think xenophobia, for the most part, is fueled by political narratives. But I think this xenophobia probably comes from a huge lack of literacy in these issues. I don't think any of us in our national schools learned about human rights, you know, learned about refugees, learned about all the wars that are currently going on that are creating refugees and what that means to the global community. So when we already have this very shaky foundation of understanding, that the moment somebody comes in and says something stupid, we're going to listen to it because we didn't really have that articulation skills to make decisions on our own. So I think it all stems from what our education system looks like, but then who really determines what goes into our textbooks?
You've been doing this for, like you mentioned, 3.5 years now. What are some of the biggest challenges you faced so far as a refugee rights advocate?
I think on one hand, you do get to witness the kind of xenophobia and harsh criticisms towards the refugee community. And as someone who stands behind them consistently, I feel that on behalf of my friends from the community, I also see the criticisms and the hate speech that go to various organizations and activists. I think on one hand, I'm pretty lucky because I've never been very public as a public figure. My advocacy has always been in support of refugee communities. So getting them to also stand up on those platforms instead of me doing it, because I feel as a local Malaysian, I'm done of dominating that space. So because I've not been in that public view, I've never had that challenge of getting hate mail to the extent that I see other people. But I think within my work, the kind of advocacy that I do through refugee leaders, I would tie that challenge there, which is working with such a diverse group of people I think existingly working with human beings are so difficult. Mm-hmm. I see adults as like tangled mess of string, you know, and everyone, you know, each tangle is due to a particular time, a particular event at a particular place, and it defines who they are today. And they've got quirks, flaws, strength, all these kind of different things that's unique to them. And it's so hard to read people. It's so hard to sometimes get honest feedback, to get that kind of that level of honesty in discussions, to get come together, you know, which is also important when we're trying to come up with advocacy plans on how do we target policymakers to see the refugee perspective, how do we go to the local communities and whatnot. When you have leaders from completely different cultures, different countries, different ethnicities, different experiences, and they're all dealing with so much on their own as individuals already. So the challenge is trying to navigate through all the complexities of bringing together different refugee leaders on a shared vision, but also to help support their capacity building. We have refugees of different ages, different sex groups, different education levels, different articulation skills, you know, different priorities. So it's also trying to wading through all of that and bring everyone onto the same level to even start the conversation efficiently on the strategies that we want to explore in advocacy terms.
Being an activist, people say, can often be a thankless job in the sense that there's a lot of sadness. There's, you know, you read the news, you see what's going on, you are right in the thick of it. You go to detention centers, you're constantly battling what appears to be a losing battle, but it's a battle that still needs to be had anyway. What keeps you going then?
I get this question in many different forms. And I think one of the most common things when I meet people and they find out about my job, they'll say things like, it's so cool, but I don't think I can do it. I don't think I'm strong enough because of all the things that you probably have to hear. And on one hand, well, I think, yeah, sure, like I hear a more extended version of all these kind of circumstances and challenges. But I still feel that in some ways, these are things that we're already exposed to in daily life. We witness, you know, inequalities, if not in our own life, in other people's lives, right? We see struggle in many facets of life of other people. And we have to ask ourselves, how do we deal with it? You know, how do we go to sleep at night knowing that there are other people struggling? For me, I feel that the job actually helps me go on. Because I don't want to be part of a world where I see that pain and not do anything about it. I feel empowered that I have that privilege to do what I love, to help people, to get paid for it, but to be a part of that progress. It's slow, it's complicated, but I think, you know, within the refugee context, from what I've heard from people who've been on the field for such a long time, things have improved slightly. Some things have regressed quite a bit, but things are changing a lot more. For me, one of the inspiring things is seeing how well the refugee community organizes itself. At the beginning, they didn't have the community organizations, they didn't have the leaders. And now, over the last few years, they've really come together to create very effective structures. They started working more with each other, working collectively. And that's inspiring for me, you know. A lot of these refugee leaders are people around my age, you know, in their late 20s to early 30s, people who have gone through so much, but the amount of passion that they have to serve their community when they could have just gone and do, you know, some random thing, try to be a freelancer online and get money and stuff like that. They chose to do this as well. Right. And if they can go on with it, they can do this, they can get through all the headaches of dealing with so many different community members when I only had to deal with like a small portion in comparison to that, they actually helped to push me on.
In the same interview with Malaysia Kini, which I brought up earlier, you mentioned something else that struck a chord with me, something that really inspired me. You said, and I quote, "I like protests. I like to go for rallies. Some May Day rallies are more exciting than others. I do not shy away from tear gas or a day when I may get killed," end quote. Now, this, as I mentioned, is incredibly inspiring, but how are you able to surrender yourself to the cause so fearlessly? What are the kinds of conversations you've had with yourself about this?
dying for something versus living for nothing is something that I used to live by. And I know that with life, I can do so much as well that is meaningful. But I think if it was ever called, if I was ever called to task, to have to sacrifice something really great for a bigger cause, that's something that I really want to be a part of. I don't want it to be just for whatever's convenient for me, then I'll do it. But I think when it comes down to the hard stuff as well, I want to be able to show that consistency of integrity as well of doing what I say I will do. It's not that I will purposely seek for risky encounters as well. But I think it's something that I've pondered that if that happens, would I be okay with it? And I think I'm fine, you know, that if it really is significant enough, that I would stand out there and do whatever that I could to add to the cause. I think like beyond protest, beyond the more radical notions, right? And I think this idea of getting killed for the causes I believe in, one of the things I really want to do is to work in high security settings, in whether it's internally displaced camps or conflict zones. I want to be able to coordinate programs for humanitarian relief aid there or any sort of programs that need coordination. And I recognize that these are very dangerous situations to put myself in, and that especially in a high security zones where there are existing conflict going on, that death is a risk that I'm taking as well. What I will get in return for it, the work that I'll be able to do, the impact that I'll be able to have, to be able to make people feel less alone, to feel supported, to feel like they exist and we see them and that we're there for them. I think that's something that I wouldn't mind dying for. If that was the last thing that I did before I die, then I'm very happy to actually.
Over the past year, we've seen a rise in xenophobia. We see these sentiments on social media, in Facebook groups, so on and so forth. What would your message to anyone who's listening, who might have doubts about the refugee community, who might think that they are coming here to steal our jobs and spread diseases, what would your message be?
On one hand, which I think is the most general narrative that we'll all push out, is the humanitarian perspective. Is that every human being deserves the right to a life of dignity and respect, regardless of whether you think they are illegal, which is quite an inhumane term, or rather undocumented, if they've been born into some sort of environment that has compelled them to do certain things that you don't think is ethical or moral, you know. Regardless of all those things, every single person is a human being and deserves to be regarded with some sort of respect. So when you look at their access to work, to a sustainable livelihood, to be able to put food on the table, to go to school, to have accessible and affordable healthcare, these are things that every human being should be given. That's just the main basis. But I think if people are still questioning it, and I'm sure that they've probably heard this narrative over and over again, but if they still feel like they're questioning it, then look more towards the intellectual side of it. Look at the studies that come out. You know, you need to understand that the economy, It's not like if I take from this side, this side will be immediately reduced, you know. Mm-hmm. Jobs don't work that way. When you give refugees the right to work, you're giving them access to better livelihoods, means now they have better purchasing power, means they can now go out to eat more, they can now purchase more products. That means that there needs to be more goods and services in the country, and that means more jobs that Malaysians can now take on. Right. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the kind of jobs that a lot of refugees take as well, considering a lot of them come from farming backgrounds or have more experience in manufacturing, they go to factories and plantations. These are jobs that Malaysians don't want to do anyway. When we start doing it, we feel like, oh my gosh, this is much harder than we thought. And then we decide to try to go for the office job instead. Right. So it's also that balance. Right. You cannot think that it's so black and white. On the other hand, the spreading of diseases, it is. It's very complex of an issue. You know, when we look at the pandemic now and people say that they live in more cramped quarters and that's why they can spread COVID a lot more. It's true. They don't have that privilege to socially distance. But you need to ask why, right? You need to keep unpacking issues to their root problems instead of looking at the surface level and then trying to blame someone. When you unpack all these issues, you come to realize that they're all systemic and they're all because of the lack of policy to even address basic fundamental human rights that every single person deserves here. Because the moment that we address these issues, we don't see inequalities, we don't see this issue of, he will steal my job, she will steal my job, or spreading disease when everybody has that same privilege to social distance, to find work that applies to them, that then helps them to contribute back to society as well. Refugees aren't looking for handouts. They really are not. A lot of refugees would say, just let us pay taxes, but to pay taxes, let us work, you know? We will pay the taxes to subsidize the healthcare cost to make it affordable. Let our kids go to school. A lot of kids have been here for 10 years. Some of them have been here for 20 years. You know, they're growing up here and they sound so much more Malaysian than I do. They know how to sing our national anthem. A lot of them know how to speak Malay. Give them that instead of trying to pretend that this problem doesn't exist. The more that we treat them as a problem, it actually becomes so much more of an issue. And all these things about stealing jobs and spreading diseases become so much more complex and harder to address.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Elise.
Thank you so much.
That was Elise Ariachan, a human rights advocate and the coordinator of the Coalition of Burma Ethnics Malaysia, talking to me about her advocacy journey so far and some of the lessons she's learned along the way. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app or bfm.my. I'm Dashan Johan, and you've been listening to Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.